Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you, young man. I'm pleased to hear you're doing well.
Young man. Right. Okay. Last weekend was the 4th of July, and it seemed as if Americans, both across the United States and Americans overseas, were either doing one of two things. They were either watching Donald Trump give a speech in front of Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, or they were watching Hamilton on Disney Plus. And I think this sort of speaks to sort of ideas about American nationalism and different ways of understanding the American nation on the nation's birthday. This week we're going to talk about sort of nationalism and the problem of nationalism and the role of historians with nationalism against a context of rising nationalism in the age of Trump and rising nationalism on the global stage with nationalism on the rise in Turkey and Russia and Hungary and a bunch of other places. Nationalism and its discontents is the topic today. Well, how did you spend last weekend, Frank? Did you watch Trump at Mount Rushmore or did you watch Hamilton?
I watched Hamilton. I did not watch President Trump, although I obviously read and viewed a lot of the coverage of President Trump's speech. And it was an interesting juxtaposition, it seems to me. I mean, I like the way you framed this, David, because it seems we're having a massive discussion and debate about history and the history of the United States and what it means. And it's become a real focal point of U.S. politics. I mean, President Trump in his July 3rd address at Mount Rushmore seemed really to be trying to make a pitch. He's seeking a campaign message. He seems to be struggling for one at the moment, and he's decided that they're coming for your history. They're out to tear our history down. Seems to be his pitch at the moment, or a key element to it. Yet we have this very, as you noted, contrasting view of American history and an engagement with the American past that we see in Hamilton, and more interestingly, perhaps, in people's engagement with and responses to Hamilton. It's not the play itself, which is fine. In fact, I think it's great, but it's interesting the way people are responding to it. So on one hand, President Trump was saying, you know, they're coming to take our history away. There'll be no George Washington. There'll be no Thomas Jefferson, etc. On the other, that's all people, at least the people we engage with, both in person and on social media and in other platforms, seem to be interested in. So there's this kind of curious paradox, and there's an argument about nationalism and history. You're right, it's a global moment where this is happening, but our particular interest on this podcast is the United States. And I would, to give this some structure, David, maybe we should think about, there was an essay that Jill Lepore published in Foreign Affairs last year when her book These Truths came out. Now, some listeners will remember we talked about Jill Lepore's book These Truths, this attempt to provide a history of the United States. And in advance of that book I think it was in the March-April 2019 issue of Foreign Affairs, Lepore published an essay calling for a new American history, and Foreign Affairs circulated that on social media again over the past week or so in light of the kind of things we've been talking about. And I think it's a really interesting essay. I don't think we need here, you know, we've both critiqued Lepore's work in the past and praised it, but I don't think we need to do that so much, and because there's been a little bit of that on social media in the past week or 10 days. So much as engaged with her call for a new history of the United States in that essay, because I think basically to sum up, keep the tagline on that essay, what she said was, we need a new history of the United States because if we, that is historians, don't write it, we're leaving it to others to write it, and they won't write a history that we want them to. And implicit in this is the kind of history that President Trump, or the kind of outline or vision of American history that President Trump and some of his supporters have endorsed. And Lepore was saying, we need to find a way to write the history of the United States to meet this current moment. And I'm thinking about the Black Lives Matter protest and the protest in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, but also the broader cultural discussion we're having about who's an American and who has purchased an American history. All these things seem to be coming together. And Lepore Lepore's essay is calling for a history of the United States as a nation state and saying that's important, and that historians shrink away from that task, and we do so at our peril. So to some extent, I think sorry, it's a long-winded response to you. I think the Mount Rushmore address combined with the kind of the return of Hamilton, or the appearance of Hamilton on Disney Plus, underscore some of these issues that Lepore raised in that essay that was recently recirculated that I think we should engage with today. What do you think? Sorry, David, that was very long-winded answer. I apologize. You know, but what do you think?
The note in Trump's speech that you mentioned about, you know, using this idea that his opponents want to tear down our history. And the question is who the our is in that, and who is the, you know, who gets to claim ownership over the past, and what does that mean about the nation state, I think is really sort of part of the debate here, or part of the thing we have to sort of wrestle with is, you know, who gets to make decisions about what gets incorporated and what doesn't get incorporated in this kind of national story. And I think one thing we need to wrestle with here at the sort of get-go is what exactly do we mean when we say the word nationalism? What is it do we mean when we talk about a nation state? Because I think those terms get used in a variety of different ways.
Yeah.
So when you use the term nationalism or nation state, what does that mean?
Oh, well, there's the rub. I think nationalism, of course, is in its modern iteration, really gets its start in the early 19th century. It doesn't get its start, but it's articulated and given an ideological foundation, I suppose. In the dying days of the Enlightenment in the early 19th century, and to some extent it replaces the kind of cosmopolitanism of the Enlightenment. The notion that there's an international republic of letters, for example, is at odds with the emphasis on a particular place that one sees and the celebration of particular places that one sees in the kind of romantic nationalism of the early 19th century. That goes hand in hand with the history and the rise of the state, especially in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And the two converge in obviously quite destructive ways in the early 20th century with the rise of fascism, when the state and the nation become one in ways that are really destructive both to human rights and to human life. And because of that, nationalism kind of I think historians in particular turned away from nationalism after the mid 20th century because of the experience of the early 20th century. So I think on one hand, nationalism can be seen as the celebration of the nation and its people. That's a pretty basic definition. The history of the state is closely related to that, but not the same thing. I saw some people on Twitter earlier and other social media earlier this week trying to distinguish between patriotism, which they saw one of these, like, nationalism is bad, but patriotism is good, or patriotism is bad, but nationalism is good. Mm-hmm. I because there are variants of these things. On one hand, there is the love of one's country and the identification with it. On the other, there are the negative associations with nationalism, which are basically, you know, our tribe is really good, and by implication, yours is really bad.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We see aspects of this in Trump's celebration of nationalism, which frankly is one of the things Lepore points out has put historians off the history of the nation and nationalism, because often we don't want to be associated with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that...
What's your definition? Well, let me turn your question back on you.
Well, so here's the tricky thing for me when I think about nationalism is... You know, nationalism is born at this particular moment in the early 19th century. It doesn't have a particular. You can find evidence of it earlier, but
sure,
it sort of rises to the fore then, and it rises to the fore in the context of the revolutions that are happening in Europe in the early 19th century, especially in 48. It has to do with sort of the unification of Germany and Italy, and how do you create. Modern in the 19th century definition of the word modern country, and you, how do you sort of build a country out of fragmented pieces And part of what you do is you create a sort of mythology about a common point of origin, a common language, a common religion. And that's how you get to establish things like Germany and Italy as nation states. And by its very nature, that kind of ethno-nationalism in Europe is a very powerful force for creating kind of group cohesion and an imagined community that Benedict Anderson and other people have talked about. But it's also at the same time, by nature, exclusive and exclusionary and discriminatory in its outlook, right? If you were saying we are a nation and what we have in common is a common culture, language, ethnicity, what have you, people who are within the geographic bounds of the state but don't share those things are thereby sort of seen as other and lesser than. And we can sort of you can see in the 20th century the outcomes of that in all kinds of horrible ways. That understanding of what a nation is and what a nation state is, and Laporte points this out, is has always been kind of tricky when you put it in the American context, in as much as is it's harder to define who an American is by those common, the European nationalism often sort of traces things back to the Middle Ages and makes claims about, their relationship to the fall of the Roman Empire or some other kind of nonsense. Americans, it doesn't always work because in the United States, its very nature, is a nation of immigrants with a variety of disparate points of origin. And just defining itself in relationship to that its sort of ancient past is very hard to do. And so, Americans have defined their nationalism maybe in a slightly different way than Europeans have.
Yeah, sorry, can I jump in there?
Yeah.
Because I think I need to complicate that a little bit.
Yeah, no, please do, because that was rambling.
No, it's quite all right. Insofar as these communities were never quite as exclusive as they may seem. So, for example, and German unification did not unify all the German-speaking states in Central Europe, and there were other
At least not
German.
initially.
No, but never actually, never. And so that's important. Italian unification, for example, the kind of modern Italian as a language kind of grows out of unification. Italians in the mid-19th century, and historians of Italian as a language will tell you this, were often mutually unintelligible to each other.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
And so unification was never quite as unified. And I've always thought that Italian and German unification need to be set beside what's going on. Your period, the Civil War and Reconstruction, could be seen as a period of American unification, brackets or not. And of course, we get the creation of the Canadian Confederacy in 1867. So it's not just ethno-nationalism and nation states that are being created in the mid-19th century. So I qualify it slightly there. You also mentioned immigration in the American context. Well, of course, that becomes for many the founding myth around U.S. nationalism, because you're right. The Americans, at least those of European descent, cannot look back to an ancient past in North America in the way that, say, the French can in France, and some imagined early or ancient origins in France. So you're right to make that distinction, but I think the details are a little bit more
Oh yeah, no, all these
complicated than
details
that. You
are
know
kind of
that.
everything when you zoom in gets more complicated. But I mean, it strikes me that one of the ways in which American nationalism has distinguished itself from some of its European variants is this idea that one could become an American and therefore become part of that national story in a way that is much more difficult to do at least in some models of European nationalism, in the ways in which they were articulated, at least in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, although again, I think in the past 70 years that has changed.
Oh, to be sure, right? I think the aftermath of the Second World War and has really, you know, reformulated what those kinds of national origin stories and rules of belonging and what those mean. You know, and going back to sort of Lepore's article, you know, one of the things that she sort of distinguishes, she sort of has two categories of nationalism. She has liberal and illiberal nationalism, you know, and she defines, she sort of uses synonyms several times through the article. Sometimes it's liberal and conservative, sometimes it's civic versus ethnic, about sort of what it is to be, what nationalism means in the American context. And one of the places where I would differ with her is she sort of suggests that after, in the sort of second half of the 20th century, American historians have given up on nationalism. And I think actually the opposite is the case. American historians think have studied nationalism more intensely since the Second World War. You know, there's been more research into what it is nationalism means and the role that nationalism has in the American narrative and in global histories. But at the same time, because American historians have studied nationalism more, they've been less attached to nationalism because they see its warts and all in a way that maybe that an earlier generation of historians may not have done. At least that's one of the ways in which I'm reading what she's talking about. Instead of, and part of what she, I think she's arguing is that we as historians should, I'm not sure, embrace nationalism, but sort of write a national history in a way that is different than the way in which ethno-nationalists want us to write national history. Is that my reading that right?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with the second part of your statement. I don't think he wants us to embrace nationalism in the way that Donald Trump hugs the American flag occasionally.
Well, which is weird.
Well, yes, it is weird. But I think she wants us, and by us I mean historians of the United States, to try to write the history of the United States as a coherent whole in ways that we are reluctant to do. So I think, you know, and to offer big interpretations. That's my reading of it, of her essay. So it's not to embrace nationalism in an, and I know you weren't suggesting this, kind of uncomplicated, celebratory way. I don't think she's asking for a celebratory, exceptionalist history of the United States, but I think she's saying if we don't try to engage with the history of the United States and put forward big ideas to help explain that history, then we're leaving it to the likes of Steve Bannon or Stephen Miller or whoever writes Trump speeches to do it. And that comes at a pretty significant price, not least just the kind of coarsening of discourse. And you know, it's been very interesting to see some of the debate on social media about Hamilton and what it means in light of 2020, some of which is very sophisticated, especially with regard to questions of race and the treatment of slavery in that show. But some of it's just bad and celebratory, patriotic, you know, kind of nonsense. And to some extent, one always gets that in talking about the history of the United States. But it's I think she wants us to she's saying if we don't provide histories that speak to the big picture, we're going to have more of that. That was my interpretation.
Well, okay, so you know, we both watched Hamilton last weekend. Is Hamilton kind of an alternative mode of nationalism that is the kind Lepore talking about or not?
It's interesting.
Because you've seen Hamilton both in person in New York and now, you know, on Disney Plus.
That's right. And I first saw it in New York in March of 2016. So I saw it not long before the one that appeared on Disney Plus was filmed. I think that was August of 2016, if memory serves. So same cast, etc. And it was an amazing experience. And seeing it in the run-up to the 2016 election was very interesting, or during the early stages of that contest was interesting. So famously, and you saw this in the Disney Plus version, you know, when they say immigrants, we get the job done, everybody cheered. And it's this kind of cathartic moment when you're in the audience. And in the waning days of the Obama, the age of Obama, that was both poignant and powerful. Whereas now you think, you know, I was struck in watching Hamilton last weekend at how much of its time, and that time being the age of Obama, it now seems. In answer to your question, it actually presents a quite conventional, and I don't say that necessarily in a critical way, but conventional interpretation of the revolution and the founding. Yeah, it gives more emphasis and attention to Hamilton than he would have got before. Now he gets too much, but that's as a consequence of the show. But it's a fairly conventional view of the founding, focusing on elites, because the casting is so original, because the music and the is so original, because the play is funny. It's conservatism with a small C. I think people didn't quite get the first time around. Now, in a kind of Black Lives Matter moment, people are saying, well, you know, that slavery's not really there. I actually think slavery's more there than people allow for. I think the casting, you know, means you can never forget slavery when you're watching this show. And I think, you know, the cabinet battle number one, when they talk about, you know, the kind of different visions of political economy of Hamilton and Jefferson, explicitly addresses slavery in important ways. So I think slavery is a little bit more than some of the critics have allowed, but it seems very much of its time. And that time is sort of 2015, and the world has changed so much since then. It seems like a long time ago. I've gotten slightly off, not quite addressing your question, but I think it presents a vision of this founding moment, which is crucial to American national identity and American nationalism. And that's going to become more, that will become more important in the next 6 years as we approach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So this is the foundational moment for American nationalism. Yet, as we noted a few minutes ago, nationalism as a kind of ideological force doesn't really gain pace until a couple of generations after the American Revolution. So this foundational moment, this moment when American nationalism is birthed, if you will, nationalism isn't that potent during the Revolutionary era itself. You know, Jefferson, for example, thought, well, you know, on his tombstone, or the monument by his grave, it says, among the three things that he's acknowledges on that monument, he says, author of the Declaration of American Independence. The implication being, my reading of that is, you know, he knew there would be others. And so this was a kind of cosmopolitan moment. You know, the American Revolution was one of several revolutions that would happen during his lifetime. And he saw them all as part of a kind of interconnected global moment of Republican Revolution that was really important. And he was giving primacy to the American Revolution because he saw it as first. It got the ball rolling. But he wasn't saying it was the most important necessarily. And that's lost by the 1830s and 40s once U.S. nationalism really gets up and running. But the founding generation would not necessarily have subscribed to that view is the point I'm trying to make. So the founding is interesting, and the founding as presented in Hamilton is very interesting. It's a relatively traditional and conventional interpretation of that.
Yeah, but I mean, the entire framing of the founding is itself a kind of a nationalist trope,
right? Oh, absolutely.
And the language we use to describe it is really born in this sort of mid-19th century idea of trying to craft a national identity, and the sort of deep mythology that we latch onto is not something from the Middle Ages or, you know, some other kind of thing like European nations did, but to this moment in the not then, not so distant past. And so they're sort of, when we watch Hamilton, we're watching both a retelling of a national myth, but we're also talking about a moment where we actually have, robust, as historians, we have robust documentation about who these people are and warts and all. And so it's a very, which puts American nationalism in similar terms to the ways in which other countries frame their nationalism, but also something that's slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, in Lepore's article, she quotes her fellow Harvard historian David Armitage, and David makes a distinction between the history of the nation state and the history of the state nation, and what he means by that, I think, at least in Lepore's telling, is, and I think this applies to the United States as a state nation, which is to say, the state, the American Revolution creates the United States as a nation state. It's not a unitary state yet. That's what your Civil War is about, but we'll leave that aside for the sake of this argument. So the state actually anticipates and is created before nationalism and national identity. I've been reading during the lockdown, I've been trying to work my way through Peter Ackroyd's 6-volume History of England. And
As
Peter
one
Ack,
does.
well,
I love people binge watch television programs, Rankin. You're walking. Okay, that's fine.
it's not
Continue.
going well because, on one hand, he's a very good writer and he loves England. And he know if you're familiar with Peter Ackroyd's work, he's a very engaging writer in many ways, and he's got a telling eye for detail. But my big problem with this, and it's very interesting to read this as a as an American citizen living in Scotland, read this history of England, and it'll be interesting. I haven't got that far yet, where how he's going to deal with the United Kingdom and the Empire as in the context of this. But leaving that aside, my biggest criticism of it is there's no big animating idea linking all of this together that weds it all together. And so when you don't have that, it's almost like it's a very well-written, well-researched thing. He's got a telling eye for detail, but it's almost like those 19th-century compendiums, that it would be called a miscellany or something like that, where it's lots of interesting facts kind of thrown together, but there's no animating thesis to it. And to some extent, that's what happens when you have the nation but no state yet, or he's writing about the formation of the state, but there's no kind of big idea. In the American context, what we get is we get the state first, and we get these foundational principles in the Declaration of Independence in particular, and in the Constitution, and then we build, you see nationalism evolving around that. And that makes means in interpreting American history as a coherent whole, as Lepore is asking us to do, we've got the big ideas there, and it's about trying to fit the history of the nation and the people in that nation, if you will, around those ideas. And the challenge comes because of the multiple perspectives and the diversity of the people, and you mentioned their diverse origins in the United States, but trying, so those big animating ideas, which you've got in Hamilton, I mean, Hamilton's great on those. Well, the history of enslaved people, and particularly the history of indigenous people,
Yeah,
are
that's the
really
tricky
difficult
bit
to
with
integrate.
this.
That's the tricky bit. How do you integrate those? That this national story around these founding principles, it's relatively easy to explain for white immigrants and their descendants in the United States. You can even do it for enslaved people if you buy into a Whiggish narrative of progress, thanks to Abraham Lincoln, all this kind of stuff, and Frederick Douglass's interpretation of American nationalism, of composite nationalism. It's much more difficult to do for indigenous people,
Is
and that's a shame.
there a teleology involved in that though? In as much as thinking especially about indigenous people, if we're going to create this sort of ecumenical national history, and we know how the story turns out, or at least how it's turned out thus far, does our knowing that then shape and distort the ways in which we're going to write this national, this broader national history, in as much as like we know that who's going to win the big military and other kinds of conflicts between indigenous people and the federal government? And are we incorporating them into a nation state and a national narrative in a way that maybe they don't want to be incorporated into a national narrative?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a few minutes ago you mentioned that nationalism is by definition exclusionary, and I think that's right. You're drawing boundaries between your people and another people. Well, there are people who have different ancient national traditions and identities within the United States and within North America that antedate the United States and may well postdate the United States, depending on how the history of that nation state unfolds in the future. And that's a huge problem. I mean, Lepore's book, These Truths, was criticized quite heavily last year when it appeared, for the relatively limited treatment within it of Native Americans and indigenous peoples in the Americas.
Which is odd, given her extensive bibliography in the early part of her career, where she was a historian of indigenous people at one point.
But because there's a kind of real problem in to go to the call in her essay that we create a new national history, it's very difficult in the American context to do that because of these competing and conflicting histories, which don't sit well within this narrative. If the founding of the nation state is the organizing principle, and to some extent, we know this from teaching, David, in order to teach American history as a survey, we're very much, subservient to and reliant on the history of the nation state, because it gives you your coherent idea. It gives you your framework. Otherwise, you're stuck with Peter Ackroyd's problem of just saying, here's a bunch of interesting facts about England.
One damn thing after another. Right.
But that makes it difficult to write a coherent, integrated history that takes account of the experience of all the people of the United States.
I mean, and when people have tried to do this, I'm thinking, actually hear about like Alan Taylor's book on the American colonies, where he's sort of decentering the East Coast and decentering the revolution as the sort of logical outcome of the colonial era. And the book ends in the last chapter's on sort of the Pacific Northwest and Alaska and try and sort of put that into the colonial narrative. Sometimes it's hard to actually follow the story through that, if there is a story, right? If nationalism is a part about creating narratives and the relationship between narratives and nationalism, if Peter Ackroyd doesn't have a narrative or an argument, it makes it hard to sort of follow. And I think when we teach courses, I think you're right that the nation state helps create the narrative, but that I think sort of is deeply problematic, because that sort of privileges certain kinds of voices and certain kinds of experiences, and I'm not quite sure how to do it in a way that doesn't.
Yeah, as somebody who, when we do the survey together, teaches the early part of American history, and I'm using air quotes that people can't see.
Yes.
The colonial period is a real challenge. It used to be colonial history focused on the history of those 13 colonies that would rebel and become the United States. And to some extent, that makes sense if you're trying to teach the coherent history of the nation and the nation state, and therefore it becomes a prologue, right? But if you try to do what Alan Taylor does, and rightly so, and we now think of vast early America now, we're trying to move beyond just the history of the United States and its antecedents. But when you do that, you do lose the coherence of it. Now, it becomes much more interesting, it becomes much more complicated, but not all of North America was colonized by Europeans and their descendants in some way, shape, or form. And there was conflict between settlers and indigenous peoples across North America. And I'm thinking, from Central America up to Hudson Bay. But not all of that territory became the United States, of course. And so there's a kind of there's a disjuncture there between the colonial history and the history of colonialism in North America and the history of the nation state, because different nation states develop in those spaces. And they're not all the same. They're similar. It's very interesting to put them in comparative context. We do see important continuities between and among them, but it's very complicated that way. And the colonial period greatly complicates what Lepore is talking about, the desire to write a history of the United States. Because if you treat the colonial period as all the prehistory of the United States and you start with Columbus, there's a kind of... I'm confusing language here, but there's a kind of imperialism to that project, assuming this is all about America, the United States of America. And that's problematic in and of itself.
We're colonizing the past.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who the we is there. One of the things I've been thinking about with regards to this whole question about nationalism and the role of historians in it is about how history gets taught to school-aged students, especially sort of at the primary and secondary levels, and thinking of, and I'm doing this, I do this a lot partially because I used to be a high school teacher, and for a while I taught people how to be high school teachers, which is kind of a weird thing to do. Thinking about sort of when did teaching American history become the critical part of the curriculum? When did that become a something that every American child did? And it doesn't start when compulsory education starts in the United States. It really actually doesn't start until the Progressive Era. So it's sort of in the 1890s, early part of the 20th century, that American history becomes compulsory as part of one's schooling. And looking at the arguments for why you teach the history of the nation state then, people cited sort of two related reasons. One was, this is the way in which you get immigrant children to become Americans, right? If you teach them the history of the nation state, that's how they will transition their national loyalty from the country they came to the country they are now living in. But the other reason was that we needed young men, and they are very particular about citing young men in this, to love their country so that when the country needs them, they'll be willing to sacrifice for their country. Which, when I started to dig into this when I was teaching people, actually teaching high school, I found that deeply disconcerting about sort of what the origins of what I was doing were, right? That the American history class you get in high school is there in part to get people to volunteer when they're 18 to go fight in the army. Because that's not what I thought I was doing, but that seemed to have been sort of much of the impetus behind those kinds of required courses that one had in middle school and high school. And I think that's part of the debate about, and it's going back to sort of Trump's speech about what it is that this national history is for. If national history is supposed to teach you to love your country in a uncritical kind of way, that's very different than the kind of version of national history that Lepore is talking about. And I think when people talk about American history, they are often sometimes speaking past each other, in part because they're applying these very different ideas of what the purpose of history is in the curriculum and in the broader national discourse.
I think that's right. I mean, look at think about the current moment. We are having a massive culture war about whether to wear masks or not. So if that's the case, you can imagine the fight about what America means.
Exactly.
Which is what history's about. And so, I do think we're talking past each other. I mean, one thing I think is interesting, and I think intellectual historians of the age of Trump will have some interesting work to do. I'm not being sarcastic here. I'm being serious in the sense that Trump's vision of American nationalism, as crudely expressed as it is and as inchoate as it is, seems to be what he's trying to do in a moment when the country is becoming more diverse is advance and embrace, for lack of a better term, an almost European-style ethno-nationalism that no longer pertains in Europe, it should be said. But, you know, it's the kind of nationalism we saw in Europe in the early 20th century, where we are the Volk. We are the people who, you know, certain people, he's promoting a kind of ethnic American nationalism for certain types of Americans that's at odds with the vision of Hamilton, and it's at odds with the demography of the country. So I think that's very interesting. Apropos of your comment earlier, I realize I'm not quite addressing the point you made about how it's taught and the origins of teaching. History was always part of social studies and civics, and it was about teaching, at least my grandparents, I don't know about yours, how to become Americans. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Now, the military aspect of it, I hadn't really thought of that. You know, that's not why history is taught today, I don't think. So even if those were its origins, I mean, you know, the Boy Scouts were paramilitaries. Does that mean we shouldn't have Boy – well, I don't think we should have Boy Scouts anyway, but that's different. but do you see what I mean? The origins of a lot of things don't bear looking into. Set the historian.
I think there is a sense, though, in which – there are people who what they want out of history education, what they want out of civics education, is they want people to come out of that loving their country in a particular kind of way and buying into certain kinds of national mythologies. And I think sometimes the historical profession has moved in a very different direction over the past 30 years about what kinds of stories that we're telling versus the kinds of stories that a certain segment of the American population wants to be articulated.
Right, but Lepore's point is just that. There's nothing wrong with the stories historians are telling, but if we don't seek to engage with the public in such a way, somebody else is going to give them a vision of national history, and we're not going to like that. We're not going to like the consequences of it. I don't think she's wrong in saying that.
No, I don't. I think there are problems with her particular prescription about how to do it.
Sure, I get that. And I get the discomfort many people, we ourselves are transnational people. You know, we live outside of the United States. We teach the history of the United States. You know, so I'm not here as a kind of flag waving, you know, drum banging nationalist, but I don't think she's wrong that we need to, the founding ideals of the United States, I actually think are pretty good. The failure of the founding generation to live up to them and every generation since is the problem, of course, but you know, those ideals and the history of those ideals, I don't think trying to write a history that tells that story is a bad thing. Oh my God, you're sighing.
I'm sure thinking. Well, no, it's the founding. You know, again, which is.
I hate that term. I hate the term.
In spite of the fact that we both use it.
It's hard not to. Yeah.
Because I think we get sort of caught up in nationalist tropes, whether we like it or not.
Try to write a book about Jefferson and Washington and not use the phrase founding fathers. That's what I'm trying to do.
or founding generation or founding. Because it is sort of this nationalist framework. You know, the ideas undergirding the both the Revolution and the Constitution and what have you, I guess it depends on which ones them you're pointing out. You know, and some of them are good, and some of them are really awful. And sometimes you can't disentangle those two categories of things because they didn't. I'm apprehensive of a sort of declensionist model where they got it right. We've just been trying to figure out how to do it as well as they did.
Oh, no.
I don't think that's what I don't think
No,
that's what
I'm
you were
not
saying,
advocating that at all. I'm not advocating that at all.
but
No, I actually think the ideals is that we're a week past the 4th of July, but the ideals is laid out, especially in Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence, and that's a
Oh,
crucial
you got to go to
distinction.
the original, the first draft,
The
not when
director's
they got
cut.
to the committee, right?
No,
Okay.
let me explain why this is important. So I, you know, the founding creed of the United States that, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There's not much there to disagree with. The use of men, okay, that's gendered. 18th century, maybe he meant humanity. I think he probably didn't, but that's, I get that there's a problem there. But
Okay.
as a creedal statement, there's not much there to disagree with. The obvious one is saying, well, yes, but one-fifth of the population were enslaved. 40% of Virginians were enslaved when he wrote those words. He himself owned 200 people in June of 1776 when he wrote those words. The reason I think Jefferson's draft is really important is because of the clause on the slave trade. And that's always derided as a kind of exercise in hypocrisy, because he blames George III for the slave trade. But it's the longest, in the long indictment of George III in the Declaration, it's a lengthy paragraph on the slave trade. I'm not going to recite it, but one of the things that, why it's important, I think, is in that paragraph, he talks about how George III violates the rights and liberties of a distant people. And he's right. So in other words, the usual response is you can read the Declaration of Independence and say, yeah, but when they said all men are created equal, clearly they only meant all white men. And that's certainly the position that Congress took. That's the implication of Congress. However, there's a more radical interpretation of that. If they had kept that clause about the slave trade, it's terrible history. But it would have it made a direct connection between the rights of Africans as men and human beings, and the implication was those rights it would have made the rights as stated in that second paragraph of the Declaration as universal as we like to believe they should be. So again, as a founding ideal, I think those are right. I think the Constitution's a mess. The Constitution's the problem. Constitution's a disaster.
Disaster.
The Declaration of Independence, I'm sorry, I'll defend, I think as organizing principles, that's not bad.
If you can divorce the ideas from the people who drafted it, maybe.
Well, I mean, do you,
I mean, I think
I mean,
I can't divorce.
did you go to the Caravaggio exhibition that was here last summer?
I unfortunately did not.
Okay, Caravaggio is an amazing painter. He's just a bastard. I mean, it's, but history's about nuance and complexity, and I am not. These are not demigods. That's why I don't like the founding and the founders and all that kind of language. But as a statement of principles that outlive those individuals, that you're basing,
Yeah, I think at the same time we're interpreting those principles in line with our contemporary, with our values.
sure, but people have always done that throughout American history
American
because
history, right?
those are the founding principles of the country. This is what's interesting. We're back to the state anticipating the nation. The English are a nation. There's no doubt about that. They are a national people. They have a national identity. They have a national history. Americans, because their history is relatively short by comparison, we actually are the citizens of the United States are in an interesting position because we have those founding principles laid out. The English have Magna Carta, and it's kind of there, but not really. The Scots have created this whole fiction around the Declaration of Arbroath, which is a nonsense. But it's just a coincidence, and I suppose we get a lot of documents similarly in the French Revolution. So the French have a similar kind of lineage that they can draw on. But Americans have these principles which animate, this is why, you know, Lepore's title, These Truths, comes from the Declaration of Independence. It makes a nonsense. Look, I want to be clear here. As history, this is problematic. We've already seen the whole colonial period from 1492 to 1776 doesn't fit this. And there are real problems, especially with indigenous peoples, in trying to write a history that incorporates all of the people of the United States are organized around these principles. So there are severe limitations to this. But as principles, I think those principles are pretty good. What's the alternative, okay, David?
The alternative to what? Creating a national history or
What is the United States? What is the organizing principle of the United States without that language and those words?
No, I think you're 100% right that the thing that defines the United States, and one of the ways in which American nationalism may be slightly different from the sort of European variants in the 19th century that we've been talking about, you know, is that fundamentally it's less about ethnicity and language and those kinds of cultural considerations, and more about the adherence to a certain set of particular principles. And the Declaration of Independence includes some of those, and the rhetoric of the Revolution includes some of those. But, you know, those principles in some ways were part and parcel with some other principles which are pretty lousy and are also been defining features of American history, whether that's, you know, the maintenance of slavery or white supremacy or and what have you, and sexism and hostility to Native Americans, which is also in the Declaration. The principles are sometimes deeply in conflict with one another. One person's claim to freedom sometimes is in contrast with somebody else's claim to equality, and those two things aren't necessarily always working in conjunction with one another, and sometimes working in tension with one another. And one way to sort of articulate the history of the United States is to use the tension between those principles as a sort of an overarching device, as much as the nation state itself. But then sort of how do you get into, if you use that, how do you then bring in people who are from a very different perspective have a very different relationship to the founding and have a very different relationship to those principles. The Native Americans are part of that. African Americans are part of that. And I think we need to, I'm not sure we've cracked it yet.
No. I agree with you on that. I think it's a bit like the story you told about the history of the teaching of American history. So yeah, just because the teaching of American history in the early 20th century was meant to prepare, in part, young men to volunteer to go to war, and we don't necessarily teach American history that way today in school, doesn't mean we shouldn't teach American history in school, right? Similarly, because the principles articulated in the Declaration of Independence, especially in Congress's version, which excludes that recognition of the rights of enslaved Africans, is a vision that I certainly wouldn't adhere to or promote, and you're rightly pushing back on that, doesn't mean that those principles as articulated in the Declaration haven't taken on a different meaning over the course of the subsequent 240 years. So,
yeah,
I think that's what's important. I mean, that's, you know, that Frederick Douglass's famous oration about the 4th of July gets to that,
sure.
And so on. I mean, I'm not ignorant of that history, and I'm not saying, oh yeah, that doesn't matter. Of course it matters, but it's, but those, without those principles to bind together citizens of the United States, there's nothing to hold them together. Because America, we're back to Americans don't have a basis for their nationalism apart from that.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is Jefferson's not that much of a nationalist because he thinks these are universal principles. They're just playing out in a particular way in North America at that time.
Yeah, I think he would argue that this is a global principle.
That's it. He's saying these are universal rights. These are natural rights. They apply to Africans.
In which case, you know.
So the irony is...
Would your man Thomas Jefferson appreciate nationalism or the nation state as the basis for American history? Would he like that idea?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. No. No, he'd be one of these guys who thinks, you know, like in Virginia, they should teach Virginia history. In Texas, they should teach Texas history.
Or alternatively, maybe he would say, maybe we should teach global and transnational history.
Exactly. So he's both a particularist and he's a universalist. Because that's what the Enlightenment was actually, his version of the Enlightenment is very much about. It's about, okay, you study your particular place. Because that's where you have control and autonomy, and that's where you can exercise. And I recognize how problematic this is. You can have democracy, et cetera, et cetera. But it's part of a universal experiment, if you will, or a global experiment.
Okay.
So he's.
That sounds like a very convoluted curriculum.
It's okay. It doesn't make any sense, and he's very complicated on this. He's not a strong nationalist. That's the argument I'm making in the book I'm working on right now.
It's then intriguing that last weekend he's both on the Mount Rushmore and in Hamilton.
Well, he's very protean that way. He's everything to everybody, which is weird because he's annoying sometimes. Although I have argued with some of my friends at Monticello, one or two people, actually not at Monticello, but in my world, who thought, oh, Hamilton's not good because Jefferson looks bad. Jefferson wins in Hamilton because David Diggs is so good portraying him. I mean, Jefferson steals the second act. I think Jefferson does. In fact, Jefferson does better in Hamilton than he deserves to because there's no way he was that funny in real life. He didn't have a good sense of humor.
Yeah, and he's better in Hamilton than he is in 1776.
Yes, exactly.
If we're thinking about musical renditions of, well, granted, the songs are better probably, but anyway, that's a matter of aesthetic judgment, I guess. Right. Speaking of aesthetic judgments, last drops, Frank.
Right. I know I promised we wouldn't return to monuments.
Every week is monuments week on the podcast.
Exactly. It's like infrastructure week for the Trump administration. But I do want to, because it's the 11th of June. So on July 9th, 1776, people in New York, including soldiers from the Continental Army, famously pulled down a statue of George III on the bowling green. And the statue was decapitated and then it was melted down. It was a lead statue and turned into bullets. So there's a kind of this is the founding. And I'm using that term sarcastically or ironically. This is the founding act of monument tearing down in American history, I think. If we take the history, certainly in the history of the United States, which had only existed for 5 days at that point.
So
this is the first moment of this kind of iconoclasm. So on one hand, it's evidence that the pulling down of monuments itself has a long history in the United States and goes back to the founding of the country. What interests me, though, is George Washington, and I came across this the other day, and I tweeted about it, so some people will know this already. George Washington responded to the tearing down of the statue of George III in his general orders to the Continental Army the next day on July 10th, 1776. And so I want to briefly read the portion from Washington's general orders to the army then. And so this is in response to the tearing down and destruction of the statue of George III. Though the general doubts not the persons who pulled down and mutilated the statue in the Broadway last night were actuated by zeal in the public cause, yet it has so much the appearance of riot and want of order in the army that he disapproves the manner and directs that in future these things shall be avoided by the soldiery and left to be executed by proper authority. And I think that's very interesting because what we see there from Washington is an acknowledgement that people can tear down statues, But also, you know, he's always concerned about order and good order. He doesn't want soldiers behaving in such a disobedient and disorderly fashion. And so he's talking about appropriate authority. So one can read this, and I got a little bit of pushback on Twitter from people who thought I was endorsing Washington's views. I just happened to come across this language the other day and thought it was interesting in terms of the current moment, because his claim that these things need to be done by the proper authority is exactly one of the arguments that people who are making for keeping up statues are saying. So as is often the case with the founders, more air quotes, is they can be read on both sides of any issue.
Right. Yes. They are a well, it's like the Bible. You can read them any way you want them to justify anything you want to do.
Indeed. And I, for what it's worth, I don't think we need George Washington's permission to tear down Confederate statues or to keep them up. I think there's a kind of originalism that I think is problematic, which might seem at odds with my previous endorsement of the principles of the Declaration of Independence. I think the Declaration's principles are great because they're protean and we can use them to make our make a more just society. I don't care what Washington thinks about statues, really, but I think it's interesting what to say. What about you?
All right. On my Monument of the Week installation. I want to endorse an article in The Atlantic by Megan Kate Nelson about Union monuments in the West. This is actually sort of connected with her recent book. And the argument she makes in this article is that there are lots of statues to Union generals in the American West, but that, you know, these guys who often get praised for fighting a war to abolish slavery, also many of them ended up fighting wars against native peoples in the West and engaged in genocide and generally awful things. And so sometimes these figures are more complicated than obviously the monuments give license to, and we should have a fuller discussion about the sort of place of these monuments in the West and whether even, you know, taking down Confederate monuments is one thing, but some of these Union monuments are equally problematic. So I want to endorse Megan Kate Nelson's article in The Atlantic.
Yes, and her recent book, The Three-Cornered War.
Three-Cornered War, which is a great book.
Yes,
it is. And she's a really, really gifted writer. She's one of the people I read when I'm looking for inspiration about how to write better. Which is something I'm desperate need of help sometimes. Right. On that note, Frank, cheers.
Cheers, David.
Talk to you next week.
Yep.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.